past 5 years have been dominated by increasing hostility between the US and its supporters in Western states and China. China's been denounced as attempting to push the US out of Asia, accused of being a threat to democracy, global peace, and the rules-based international order. It's been accused of corrupting the international system of trade and investment using subsidies to help its corporations take over global markets. It's accused of planning an invasion of Taiwan, no later than 2027, according to the American administration. And Joe Biden has made it clear, as have the Republicans, that America would go to war to defend Taiwan against a Chinese invasion. Leading forces in the American military have declared, including the head of the Navy, that their forces had to be literally, this is the phrase, ready to fight tonight. Ready to fight tonight, or next week, or next year. But the hostility to China hasn't just been talk. Trump imposed punitive tariffs on Chinese imports. Tariffs are taxes on imports that make them more expensive and harder to sell in the United States, as well as bans on certain imports. The American military is engaged in ever more provocative actions along the Chinese coastline. It's torn up its promise not to arm Taiwan, a promise it made many, many years, decades ago, and there's very little left of its ambiguous one China policy. These provocations came to a head in 2022 when the Speaker of the US House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, visited Taiwan. So she's the third most significant political figure in the United States. China responded with its most aggressive military exercises ever in the South China Sea and over and around Taiwan. And, you know, absolutely, you could see the potential for war. Then in late 2022, Biden sent what he called the CHIPS Act to Congress to spend over $50 billion American dollars to subsidize the design and production of advanced microchips on US soil. At the same time, it warned that any company in the world that sold either advanced chips to China or supplied China with the equipment to make its own would be sanctioned globally by the US. So the Americans imposed global sanctions on the entire rest of the world. The aim was to prevent China developing either equipment or military assets that were as advanced as America, to prevent European states selling technology to China, and to lock China into relative technological weakness. Here in Australia, the Morrison government set out to whip up fears of China. When it demanded an investigation into the origins of the coronavirus, Beijing put sanctions on a range of Australian exports, and this, of course, whipped up incredible hostility towards China and also Chinese people. Peter Dutton, who was then Minister for Defence, said it was inconceivable that Australia would not join the United States in a conflict with China. In the South Pacific, China signed a defence agreement with the Solomon Islands, provoking hysteria in the ruling classes here and in the US. And this was the background to Morrison's proposal for the AUKUS alliance, to get the US and Britain to provide technology for nuclear-powered submarines for the Australian military. The only rationale for AUKUS submarines was to fight a war thousands of kilometres from Australia in the seas around China. They make no sense at all otherwise. Now, these days, it seems that both sides have taken a step back. Xi Jinping has sidelined many of the wolf warrior diplomats who aggressively pushed demands on weaker nations and actually demoted their leading wolf warrior spokesperson on TV. China and America have resumed talks. China took the opportunity of a change in government here to open talks with Penny Wong and Albanese. So while the step back from confrontation is welcome, I think we have to be clear. The forces underlying the drive to war have not gone away, and if anything, have intensified. Now, to understand the conflict between China and the West, we need to briefly turn to the writings of the Russian revolutionaries Nikolai Bukharin and Vladimir Lenin. In the midst of the First World War, they argued that we were now in a new era. They called it imperialism. By imperialism, they did not mean the colonization of weak regimes by rich and powerful Western states, although that was one of the features of the imperialism of some countries. They meant instead that this was now a global order of capitalist competition between large corporations dominating their home markets, competition which now involved their governments and their militaries, their state machines. The corporations in the British steel industry were in cutthroat competition with German steel corporations and the Americans, including in their home markets. No great power could afford to have its steel industry smashed by foreign rivals, so where necessary, they stepped in to defend it. Likewise for machine tools, textiles, chemicals, locomotives, and the other modern industries of the time. They imposed tariffs and, where necessary, used their military power to guarantee supplies of raw materials like cotton, rubber, iron ore, and so on. When the German government tried to expand its sphere of influence and markets at the expense of Britain and France, it lit the fuse for war, which then came as a result of conflicts and imperialist interventions in the Balkans. So for Lenin and Bukharin, the First World War was not a war for democracy. Britain's ally in the East, Russia, was a dictatorship. Instead, they argued that capitalist rivalry had become so intense and so global that the rising power, Germany, could not survive as a power unless it forced a redivision of spheres of influence in the world. And Britain could not survive as a power unless it prevented this. For its part, the United States saw the opportunity of the First World War to dramatically expand its influence and markets. Capitalists had always required a strong state to protect their exploitation of workers and their right to safely own the commodities produced by workers. Now they argued, this is Lenin and Bukharin, the logic of capitalist competition was to drive those states to war, global war if necessary, to protect and strengthen their capitalists. Now, I think this analysis of imperialism helps us understand the intensifying conflict between the US and China. Put simply, China won globalization. Phrase I've used before, I think it's the central way to understand what's going on. And winning globalization has made it an existential threat to American corporate and military power, and of course, the regimes that follow American leadership and have their own independent interests. In the 1990s, with the Soviet Union dismembered and Russia in crisis, the US led negotiations to rewrite the global rules for trade and investment, dramatically increasing the right of multinational corporations to sell into foreign markets and invest overseas, and to produce and run services in foreign countries. And this was done in order to increase the wealth and power of American corporations. That's why the American government did it. And one result was the establishment of the World Trade Organization in 1995. But when China joined the WTO in 2001, and the Americans didn't want it, Australian government, the coalition government supported it, it had to allow foreign corporations to sell within China and produce within China. Some did and made a fortune, others just thought it was all too hard. But the WTO also gave Chinese capitalists a massive potential market, a global market, and they grabbed the opportunity. They sold commodities more cheaply than other capitalists on the basis of exploitation of Chinese workers. They ploughed most of their profits back into more and more advanced means of production, improving quality and cutting costs even further. The result is that from being a relatively backward economy 30 years ago, China is now the largest manufacturing economy in the world by far. So if you look at the figures, China now produces 28% of global manufacturing output. 30 years ago, it was 3%. The United States is under 17%. Like, that's the gap between first and second. Japan, 7.5%. Germany, 5.8%, less than a quarter of China. And so it goes on. The United Kingdom, 1.8% compared to China, 28.4%. So like Japan and the US before it, China's capitalists have used their profits to produce more and more sophisticated products and invested vast sums in research and development. Just one little figure, Huawei, the controversial Chinese telecom, invests over $50 billion a year in research and development. That is more than the entire Australian economy spends on research and development. One company. China's incredible rise has also increased its military power with sophisticated fighter planes, warships, missiles and nuclear weapons. And this has led to panic in the American, Australian and European ruling classes and to Biden's attempt to stop any further rise in China's productive power. Now, I want to illustrate this and see how it's continuing to be a problem for global imperialism by looking at the rise of China's car industry, which is today by far the largest in the world. China has now also passed Japan as the world's biggest car exporter. Chinese-made cars now have 16% of the Australian market. Who knew? 5 years ago, it was 0.9%. So there's 20 times as many Chinese cars being sold today in Australia, 20 times as many as 5 years ago in raw numbers. It has overtaken South Korea to be number three in Australia. When it comes to electric cars, Chinese-made electric cars have 85% of the Australian market for electric cars. So when you see a Tesla driving around, that's made in China. Okay? When you see an MG driving around, that's made in China, and so on. 30% of the cars produced in China are electric, 25% of China's car exports are electric, and China has 20% of the European electric vehicle market. China's BYD is now the world's largest producer of electric vehicles, ahead of Tesla. The battery BYD developed for its electric cars, called the Blade, is way more advanced than Tesla's. Indeed, outside the US, Tesla cars now use Chinese-developed batteries. They're not used in the US because, of course, the US don't allow China's batteries to be imported. At the same time, half of all the Chinese car factories producing cars that use fossil fuels are now idle, closed. Right? So they're just shutting down the fossil fuel car industry in China. So how did China achieve this approaching global dominance, certainly this position of incredible global power in the global car market? In 2009, the Chinese government designated electric vehicles as a strategic emerging industry. This is 15 years ago. It imposed protectionist tariffs and gave generous subsidies. The result was predictable: incredible levels of waste and corruption and low-quality goods. Under this stimulus, in 2014, more than 80,000 companies registered to enter the electric vehicle sector in China. 80,000 companies. But having got business involved, the government began to squeeze them. It began cutting support, raising the requirements for support. Low-tech producers were driven out. There was a price war. Once the domestic industry was strong enough, it began to lower its protectionism. While competitors went broke, BYD increased its spending on research and development. It went from barely surviving to quadrupling sales in just 2 years. Last year alone, Chinese companies launched 100 new electric vehicle models. In the rest of the world, like, you could put the number of new models on the fingers of one hand. Now they're focusing on expanding into Europe, and the European Commission has launched an anti-subsidy probe. It might be too late for that. Chinese car manufacturers don't need subsidies anymore. So far from bringing states closer together, this business competition on this global scale is driving states closer and closer to confrontation. And so, of course, in Europe, what's happened is that this means that the European car industry is mobilising to block Chinese imports. The problem they have is that one of the world's biggest car manufacturers, Volkswagen, gets most of its profits from China. It's one of the biggest car corporations in China. So they've got their fingers in both pies and they're squeezed both ways. Meanwhile, after years of attacking Chinese government subsidies to business, the US is now engaged in a colossal subsidy program for computer chips. So we can see here the pattern. China, the EU, the US are all using state power to expand production and improve technology and to limit access to their rivals. Both are using their state power to shape markets and produce globally competitive businesses. Now, the problem here is that no side can tolerate failure or defeat. Joe Biden's sanctions on selling advanced microchips to China is a gamble. In the past, China was content to buy advanced chips from Taiwan. Now the Chinese government has been driven to spend hundreds of billions of American dollars, trillions of yuan, to develop its own advanced chips. We don't know what will happen. What will happen if China succeeds? Not only will it pose an economic challenge to America and other Western corporations, it will be a military threat to the US and its allies. What happens if China fails? It will be a disaster for vast areas of Chinese industries, computers, smartphones, all locked into relative backwardness, and a disaster for its military. And the cost of that failure will have been colossal. What happens if China's electric vehicles take over a significant part of the European market? A catastrophe for one of Europe's major industries. And we have to keep in mind, the car industry globally, in every state that has a car industry, is seen as absolutely pivotal for all manufacturing because of the range of technologies involved, the skills required for workers in the industry, the skills required in design, factory planning, and so on. It's a strategic, pivotal industry in modern manufacturing. What happens if Europe uses tariffs to limit China's access to the market? It will make electric vehicles more expensive in Europe and drive China to increase its influence in the rest of the world. And of course, it will intensify military tension. Locking Japan's exports out of Western markets in the 1930s and also out of Europe's Asian colonies was one of the major triggers to Japan's decision to go to war in 1941. And what happens when there's a new economic crisis, a new global economic crisis? Not the kind of sort of squeezed profitability we have at the moment, but a serious crisis. All major economies will be trying to flood overseas markets with goods they can't sell at home and will be ramping up barriers to imports from their rivals. The dynamic towards war was recently spelled out by one of America's leading strategists. The very unlovely Elbridge Colby. Colby was a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense in the early Trump administration. He rewrote the national security strategy in 2018 to focus on war with China. And he was in charge of strategy for the Department of Defense in the United States. So this is not some, you know, think tank idiot with, you know, a Twitter account. This is what he had to say. The stakes are economic in nature. The stakes are basically who controls or has a dominant influence in the global economy, and particularly the economy in Asia, which is going to be the major market area in the future. Okay, the stakes are economic. Goes on. What matters is the military balance and regional hegemony in Asia. If we get that right, everything else more or less is manageable, by which he means Ukraine, Middle East, and so on. If we get that wrong, we're toast. It's pretty clear. He goes on. The reason why we care so much about Taiwan is that the Taiwan issue is not narrowly about Taiwan. It's about the overall military and geopolitical balance. In other words, we don't give a stuff about Taiwan. Actually, we're at the process of plundering their microchip industry and forcing it to largely relocate into the US behind Biden's CHIPS Act subsidies. Taiwan is a lever in the war, the conflict with China. Well, take a step back, because I think what we also have to see is that far from being used to benefit ordinary people, the incredible productivity and technological advances of modern capitalist industry are being used to destroy rival businesses and take the world to the brink of catastrophe, climate catastrophe, economic catastrophe, and war. We also have to be clear that we can stop this. The US used to pretend that its rivalry with China was a conflict between democracy and autocracy to win support at home. That was always a lie. I mean, I don't think the US ever found a dictatorship it couldn't fall in love with. And of course, you know, after the Second World War, you look at the dictatorships the US supported. You know, Chiang Kai-shek in Taiwan, Park in Korea, the Vietnamese regime, Marcos in the Philippines. You can just go on. They love them all. But now the world sees the American government through the prism of Gaza as the defenders, facilitators and armors of the genocide in Gaza. That's the democracy America stands for. In Australia, we've had a steady ramping up of militarism as universities have competed for military-focused research contracts and STEM courses at schools have become used to promote the military. Now, all that's under challenge as a result of their links to the genocide in Gaza. Right, so there was a movement against that before, but it's now a movement on steroids. In Asia, most regimes are opposed to the US-China rivalry and terrified of what a war between them would involve. Australia's AUKUS submarine deal has also created huge anger in Southeast Asia. It's seen rightly as not just a threat to China, but a potential military threat to other Asian states. A means by which the Australian government can bully, you know, weaker Asian states to do what Australia wants, the Australian government wants. Here at home, there's been a growing chorus of opposition to AUKUS from within the ruling class and the Labor Party. Now, I have to say, openly, I never thought that I would ever be forced to say anything positive about Paul Keating. I mean, Paul Keating, like, for people of my generation, Paul Keating is just, I mean, to call him an, anyway, he was the architect. He was the architect of Labor's neoliberalism in the 1980s, which, and of course, the subsequent smashing of trade union strength in Australia. The Treasurer who said that the 1990s economic crisis was, quote, the recession we had to have. And of course, it was workers who had the recession. Unemployment up to 10, 11%. His attacks on AUKUS have shocked and terrified not just people in the ruling class, but many Labor cabinet ministers and galvanised opposition to AUKUS within Labor Party branches. Partly that's because the Labor Party has many older people, members, people my age, who cut their teeth campaigning against the war in Vietnam and against uranium mining during the Fraser and Hawke governments, and they've passed those traditions on to younger members. Now, these people are not the people who are going to destroy AUKUS, but they are playing an outsized role. I mean, you know all the problems with the Labor Party. They're playing an outsized role at this very moment, because the result of all of that was a huge fight over AUKUS at the last Labor Party National Conference, and a resolution that actually, I think, was a political defeat for Albanese. One that said that the AUKUS submarines did not commit Australia to joining an American war. The government did not want any motion like that on AUKUS. The real key hope for the future lies in the day-to-day class struggle. Today, of course, in China, young university graduates can't find decent work. Many of the jobs they are offered are 996 jobs, 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. 6 days a week, right? It's a phrase. There's a whole movement against this kind of super hyper exploitation. While there's trillions for industrial modernisation of the military, social welfare is miserable. There's a squeeze on funding for schools. Schools in China provide meals for students at lunchtime, right? And the way they're described is nanchu, in other words, difficult to eat. We see the regime adopting an entirely new policing strategy, which emphasised total regime security and the proactive prevention of large gatherings, specifically at universities. The regime was terrified by the implications of the white paper movement against the lockdowns, which didn't just go to Shanghai and Beijing, But I've seen reports that list 1,000 universities in China that had some form of anti-lockdown protest in that brief period of time. And of course, this repression of demonstrations is something that wouldn't happen in the West, would it? And so, I mean, I think it's important to see that This is what happened in the lead up to the First World War and the Second World War. Imperial rivals are mirroring each other's strategy for conflict and their strategies for containing unrest and anger at home while resources are thrown into fighting their rivals. Now, we can't jump over the problems we face in stopping AUKUS, stopping Australia's aggression towards the island states of the Pacific, stopping its alliance with the United States, its China bashing, and so on. The argument that China is a brutal dictatorship and that would smash everything workers have fought for here is a powerful argument in Australia. I just want to make one brief comment about that. It is incredibly important that we do not overstate the degree of repression in China. Obviously, we're not at all interested in understating it. We do not want to overstate it. There is class struggle in China. There are strikes. There was the white paper protests. If you think that resistance is impossible in China, where does it lead you? It leads you to the reactionary conclusions of many of the activists in the Hong Kong movement, and indeed many activists in Taiwan, that the only way to protect yourself is to find a saviour outside. And that saviour is the Stars and Stripes military. Right? That's where it leads. Actually, the class struggle, the Chinese government is terrified of the class struggle. Xi Jinping's speeches are just full of references to the imperative that the party maintain social peace and social cohesion. He doesn't say those things because they've achieved it. He says it because actually that's their fear. And of course we have nationalism, the terrible strategies of the trade union, many of them on the trade union left, who are important to this struggle, who, for instance, see AUKUS as a vehicle for jobs, or who just simply have a nationalist perspective and genuinely don't see workers overseas as part of the same struggle. But every success today over Gaza, school funding, democratic rights will make a difference when bigger opportunities open up to take on our bosses and the system driving us towards economic crisis, environmental collapse and war, which is why it's so important to have conferences like Keep Left, why it's so important for us to build solidarity to play a role in those struggles and shape them in the future. Thanks.